I found it somewhat amusing that Mr. Trump, President Trump, was punching the establishment, but right behind him, John, sitting in the VIP sections, were billionaire after billionaire after billionaire, some of the most powerful people in this country, who over the last 10, 20 years have become much, much richer while the middle class has shrunk. So I find it somewhat amusing that you're attacking the establishment when the establishment is sitting right behind you, and when billionaires and large corporations are funding many of your inaugural events.
So we're approaching the 100-day mark for the Trump presidency, and it's an arbitrary number. I mean, let's be honest. It doesn't really mean anything to be approaching that number. Presidents serve 4-year terms. Generally, they serve 2 of them. Very few exceptions are there to that rule. But as we come up on this 100-day mark, I've often wondered with the president, President Trump, going back on so many of the things that he promised, and his supporters don't seem to care. It seems that the truth is only, really only, whatever they want to believe. I saw an SNL skit recently with Alec Baldwin playing Donald Trump, and he said, even though, you know, as the character, he goes, even though I'm not doing anything that I said that I was going to do, you guys still support me no matter what. You know, depending on which polls you look at, somewhere between like 11% and 3% of people, you know, say they've regretted it, but the rest of them don't. So we'll get at least say at least 9 out of 10 are still happy they voted for me. He's doing the exact opposite of everything that he said he was going to do, but they're still glad that they voted for him. And in the SNL skit, he goes, "I love you people because you, it's like you found a finger in your chili. And because you love chili so much and you are so excited about the chili, you've decided to just eat around the finger rather than raise any flags." So I began to think about communication, the way we communicate with each other largely. So when it comes to our media is pitting us against one another in a big way. And they're not doing so because they want to upend America, or they want us to hate each other, and they want us fighting in the streets. No, it's nothing like that. They're really, they need eyes, and they need ears, and they need to make money. And they need you to flock to the advertisers that are on their program. That's the only thing that they are actually trying for. So I do things like this, and I try to engage in conversation with conservatives. And I try to encourage other people to do the same thing. And I wondered why it's so hard to make that particular thing happen. See, I'm not afraid to talk. I'm not afraid to debate. I'm not afraid to say what I think. And I'm not afraid for you, whoever you are, to challenge what I think. I'm pretty confident in what I believe. I've spent quite a bit of time pondering it, reading about it, soul searching and all of those things. But it still seems within, I would feel like most people should feel like I do. They should be where I'm at on this particular thing. If your beliefs are so tightly held, are so strong for you, then why don't you just go ahead? And when you talk about them, you don't have to be angry and you don't have to be combative. There's really no room for that. So why aren't more people talking? And if your position is so great, why aren't you spending more time trying to bring people to you? So when I listen to conservative talk radio, it's just hate. And a lot of folks have taken issue with that word. You're calling right-wing radio hate radio. Let me qualify that. If you're arguing against the LGBT community getting equal rights, that's hate. If you're arguing for discrimination based on whatever religion you subscribe to, that is hate. If you want to have Muslims banned from the country because they're Muslim or because you believe they're carrying out all the terrorist attacks in America, when it's not true, according to the FBI, most terrorist attacks, the overwhelming amount of terrorist attacks are carried out by white Christian men armed with guns. But if you believe it's the brown people, that's hate. If you think that it's up to you what a woman does with her body, that's hate. Need I go on? That big stupid wall that you want to build on the southern border, which isn't going to do anything. Remember, we have airplanes. That big stupid wall you want to build on the southern border is going to stand as nothing more than a giant monolithic sign of your racism. That's it. And by the way, most people immigrating into this country aren't coming from the south. They're coming from the north. But I'm not hearing about a north wall. I rest my case. So when I listen to conservative talk radio, it's just hate. It's hate for all these groups. They don't call it that. They call it good old style American and it's exceptionalism. And when I listen to progressive talk radio, they've decided to take more of the humorous approach, not the angry, gritting your teeth, spitting everywhere approach that the conservatives have taken. And I think that that is more style than anything. I think what drives progressives is just that, progress. They would like to see progress, progress in relations with the world and at home, you know, progress with respect to poverty, progress with respect to just people in their own lives. I think they just want to see things better for most people. And I know conservatives would take issue with that. Hold on, I'm getting to you folks. But for conservatives, it seems that what drives them is fear. Right, this horrible, the brown people are coming, everybody wants to bomb us. They're just driven by fear and the idea that they are truly the victim. It's not the gays that are being beaten up. It's not the Muslims that are being beaten up and killed. It's them. They're the actual victim because their religion is being taken, their free speech, which is all crap. You go into any town in America, you flip on the radio, all you're going to hear is conservative talk radio. If somebody is suppressing your free speech, they're doing a piss poor job of it. And your religion, we celebrate Christmas. Christ is right in the name. Of course, you believe there's a war against it. But everybody celebrates Christmas. The numbers of people who celebrate Christmas is very, very tiny. And if that constitutes a war, I think you need to look up what the word war means. There are plenty of churches on every corner. Most of them Christian or something related to it. Jehovah's Witnesses, Mormons. There's a church where Christ is at the center of it. On every corner, if somebody is suppressing your religion, then once again, they're doing a piss poor job of it. And how many religious movies has Hollywood made? Whole liberal Hollywood, how many religious movies have the piss poor job? But you can't talk to conservatives about this particular issue. They believe that they're the victim, right? They're the slighted one, no matter what. So if they believe that they're the victim, And what they largely use is fear and hate to get their message across. And progressives, you know, have this idea, you know, where, and it's not just progressives, it's everybody gets to get under some sort of umbrella, right? We get wages, you know, so that people don't have to work 15 jobs just to survive, so that everybody has enough food. You know, nobody's trying to get disgustingly wealthy. And that, of course, is referred to as socialism, which it is not. And I've always admired the fact that progressives were willing to take a different route with respect to their dialogue. But I was recently reading an article in The Atlantic magazine, so The Atlantic, The Guardian, The Intercept, these have become some of my primary sources. Washington Post has recently become another one of my favorites, but I digress. So I was reading an article in The Atlantic recently called How Late Night Comedy Alienated Conservatives, and it starts off like this. A month after the election, Trevor Noah, the host of The Daily Show, published an op-ed in the New York Times that sought to position himself and his show as instruments of healing in a broken land. It was called Let's Not Be Divided, Divided People Are Easier to Rule. And it zapped around progressives' inboxes and Facebook feeds like a digital bomb of Gilead. It was a reminder that we were not, in those fevered weeks, being ourselves. talking about the election. I'm still quoting here. Instead of speaking in measured tones about what unites us, we're screaming at each other about what divides us. How true that was. One might churlishly observe what a sea change that is from Noah's tone during the campaign when he berated Donald Trump for tweeting with those fat little tiny fingers of yours and for trying to think with that stupid head. And when he advised the candidate that maybe you should just look in the mirror, a-hole, what the article goes on to point out is that humor, which is used by John Oliver, which is used by Stephen Colbert, which is used by Trevor Noah, which is used by Samantha Bee, that humor turned into a very powerful form of propaganda for conservatives during the election. I've pointed out that there is no liberal media. If you look around at the media landscape, they're not putting progressive issues front and center. If you, like I said a few moments ago, if you turn on talk radio, all you're going to hear is conservative talk anywhere in America. When I listen to conservative talk, all I got to do is flip on the AM dial. If I want to hear progressive talk, I have to fire up the internet on my telephone to listen to progressive talk because it's nowhere. And I live in Portland, Oregon. That doesn't make any damn sense. But even with that, there's still this gigantic belief that we have a liberal media. So what do we have? We have a media run by and for money. But when conservatives see Stephen Colbert, or they see Samantha Bee, or they see John Oliver, or they see Bill Maher, they don't see those particular people for who they are. Just as liberals dealing with this the way that liberals tend to deal with things, and that's with a dose of humor. They see Comedy Central. They see CBS. They see HBO. That's what the article points out. And then that is what they begin to associate with liberal media. And then they say, well, clearly the media is liberal. And I can't listen to the media, so I should do what Donald Trump tells me to do, and that's to listen to him and him alone. And that's how dictators get their dictatorships.
We're losing a lot of people because of the internet, and we have to do something. We have to go see Bill Gates and a lot of different people that really understand what's happening. We have to talk to them, maybe in certain areas, closing that internet up in some way. Somebody will say, oh, freedom of speech, freedom of speech. These are foolish people. We have a lot of foolish people. We have a lot of foolish people. We've got to maybe do something with the internet.
What I want to talk to you about today is a book called Don't Think of an Elephant. And it's written by George Lakoff, who is a professor and a bit of a linguist. Now, the best way to communicate with somebody else is to really speak their language. Well, we all speak English, right? Well, by and large, you know, that's the language that's spoken most in America. But what I really mean is you need to be able to speak to them in terms that they understand. When it comes to progressives, you flip on progressive radio, you know, they tend to use language that progressives understand, more, you know, inclusive language, you know, talking about reaching out to other groups and things of that nature. But when you go to conservative talk radio, it's very tightly controlled. If you flip on the dial, they put things in frames that conservatives are used to and that conservatives can understand. And what it does is it gets into their cognitive unconscious. When you hear a word, its frames, quoting here, or collection of frames is activated in your brain. So in the book, and it's all about framing, and he says this is what framing is about. Framing is about getting language that fits your worldview. It's not just language. He talks about the students in his class, you know, and he tells a story about after a student turned in a particular paper. And he said, first of all, he says, I have the exact opposite position on every issue as do my conservative counterparts. What do my positions have to do with one another? and I couldn't figure that out, he says. So he says, at this point, I remembered a paper that one of my students had written some years back that showed that we all have a metaphor for the nation as a family. We have founding fathers. We have the daughters of the American Revolution. We, of course, send our sons to war. This is a natural metaphor because it's one that we pretty easily understand in large social groups, like nations, in terms of small ones, like families, or like communities. One of the leading voices in conservatism is a man called James Dobson. James Dobson talks to his audience in what is known as a strict father model. We've got two models here: the way you talk with conservatives and the way that you talk with progressives. And conservatives subscribe to, unconsciously, the strict father model. And then, of course, you probably think for progressives, then it's the mother. No. It's the nurturant parent. Quoting here, the world is a dangerous place, and it always will be, because there's an evil out there in the world. The world is also difficult because it is competitive. There will always be winners and losers. There's an absolute right and an absolute wrong. Children are bad, are born bad, in the sense that they want to do what feels good, not what is right. Therefore, they have to be made good. This is from James Dobson, from his book, Dare to Discipline. What is needed is, in this world, is a strong, strict father who can protect the family in a dangerous world, support the family in a difficult world, and teach his children right from wrong. What is required of the child is obedience, because the strict father is a moral authority who knows right from wrong. It is further assumed that the only way to teach kids obedience, that is right from wrong, is through punishment, painful punishment. When they do wrong, this includes hitting them. And some authors on conservative child rearing recommend sticks, belts, and wooden paddles on the bare bottom. Some authors suggest this start at birth, but Dobson is more liberal. Quote, there is no excuse for spanking babies younger than 15 or 18 months of age. Of course, after that, all bets are off. The rationale behind physical punishment is this: what children do, when children do something wrong, they are physically disciplined, they learn not to do it again. That means that they will develop internal discipline to keep themselves from doing wrong, so that in the future they will be obedient and act morally. Without such punishment, they will go to hell and there will be no morality. Such internal discipline has a secondary effect. It is what is required for success in the difficult and competitive world. That is, if people are disciplined and pursue their self-interest in this land of opportunity, they will become prosperous and self-reliant. Thus, the strict father model links morality with prosperity. The same discipline you need to be moral is what allows you to prosper. This link is the pursuit of self-interest. Given opportunity and discipline, pursuing your self-interest should enable you to prosper. So, Dobson is very clear about the connection between the strict father worldview and free market capitalism, what we refer to as free market capitalism. The link is the morality of self-interest, which is a version of Adam Smith's view on capitalism. Adam Smith said that if everyone pursues their own profit, then the profit of all will be maximized by the invisible hand, right? Remember the invisible hand of the free market, that is. By nature, just naturally. Go about pursuing your own profit and you're helping everybody. That's the belief. This is linked to a general metaphor that views well-being as wealth. For example, if you do a favor, you say, I owe you one, or I'm in your debt. Doing something good for someone is metaphorically like giving him money. He owes you something and he says, how can I ever repay you? So, applying this metaphor to Adam Smith's law of nature, if everyone pursues their own self-interest, then by the invisible hand, by nature, the self-interest of all will be maximized. That is, it is moral to pursue your self-interest, and there is a name for those who do not do it. The name is do-gooder. A do-gooder is someone who is trying to help rather than herself, and is getting in the way of those pursuing their self-interest. It is believed that do-gooders screw up the system. So if you're working to better yourself, selfishness is very much at the center of this. And remember, they say, the father raises you, He raises you strictly. He teaches you physical punishment for the things that you do wrong. And then you go out in the world, you pursue your own self-interest, and with that, good things will come to you. If you go out in the world and you're a do-gooder and you're trying to help other people, well, you're just screwing up the whole system. In this model, there's also a definition of what it means to be a good person. A good moral person is someone who disciplined enough to be obedient, to learn what is right, to do what is right, and not do what is wrong, and to pursue her self-interest to prosper and become self-reliant. A good child grows up to be like that. A bad child is one who does not learn discipline, does not function morally, does not do what is right, and therefore not disciplined enough to become prosperous. She cannot take herself and thus becomes dependent. When good children are mature, they have either learned discipline and can prosper or have failed to learn it. From this point on, the strict father is not to meddle in their lives. This translates politically into no government meddling. So, do right, beat the piss out of your kids, using my own language here, teach them discipline, then they will go out in the world and they will do fine on their own. But remember, you're the strict father. After they are out there on their own, you do not interfere anymore. This is also the same take they have when it comes to government. No meddling in other people's lives. Don't be a do-gooder and don't meddle in other people's lives. People should have had the crap beat out of them when they were a kid so they can figure it out now. I'm sorry, my own language, I understand. I'm making a point here. Okay, now let me talk a bit about how progressives understand the morality and their moral system. It too comes out of a family model, quoting here what I call the nurturant parent model. So we got the strict father and the nurturant parent. The strict father worldview is so named because according to its own beliefs, the father is the head of the family. The nurturant parent worldview is gender neutral. Okay, both parents are equally responsible for raising the children. The assumption is that children are born good and can be made better. The world can be a better place, and our job is to work on that. The parents' job is to nurture their children and raise their children to be nurturers of others. So, what does nurturance mean? It means two things: empathy and responsibility. If you have a child, you have to know what every cry means. You have to know when the child is hungry, when they need a diaper change, when they're having nightmares. And you have a responsibility. You have to take care of this child. Since you cannot take care of someone else if you are not taking care of yourself, you have to take care of yourself enough to be able to take care of the child. This isn't all easy. Anyone who's ever raised a child knows how hard it is, knows that you have to be strong. You have to work at it. You have to be competent. You have to know a lot. In addition, all sorts of other values immediately follow empathy and responsibility. Think about it. If you empathize with your child, you will provide protection. This comes in politics in many ways. What do you protect your child from? Crime and drugs, certainly. You also protect your child from cars without seatbelts, from smoking, from poisonous additives in food. So progressive politics focuses on environmental protection, worker protection, consumer protection, and protection from disease. These are things that progressives want the government to protect their citizens from because we believe in the nurturant parent model. But there are also terrorist attacks, which liberals and progressives have not been good at communicating about. That would be protection. Protection is part of the progressive moral system, but it has not been elaborated on enough. On September 11th, progressives did not have a whole lot to say, and that was unfortunate because nurturant parents and progressives do care about protection. Protection is important. It is part of our moral system. Second, if you empathize with your child and you want your child to be fulfilled in life, to be a happy person, and if you're a happy, unfulfilled person yourself, you're not going to want other people to be happier than you are. The Dalai Lama teaches us that. Therefore, it is your moral responsibility to be a happy, fulfilled person. Your moral responsibility, further, it is your moral responsibility to teach your child to be a happy, fulfilled person who wants others to be happy and fulfilled. This is part of what a nurturing family life is all about. It's a common precondition to care about others. And there are other nurturant values for progressives. If you want your child to be fulfilled in life, the child has to be free enough to do that. Therefore, freedom is a value. You don't have very much freedom if there's no opportunity or prosperity. Therefore, opportunity and prosperity are progressive values. If you care about your child, you want your child to be treated fairly by you and others. Therefore, fairness is a value. If you're communicating with your child and you empathize with that child, you have an open two-way communication, honest communication. This becomes a value. You live in a community, and that community will affect how your child grows up. Therefore, community building, service to the community, and cooperation have also become values. To have cooperation, you must have trust. To have trust, you must have honesty and open two-way communication. Trust, honesty, open communication, they're fundamental progressive values. I want to talk about one more, just real quick, the first ones I covered. Opportunity, prosperity, freedom. The frame the conservatives put those in is when you are that strict father, if you're following that strict father model and you're not helping people and you're not a, doing the air quotes here, you're not a do-gooder. For someone to be free, you have to leave them alone. You should not help them out. Or the in a larger sense, in a macro sense, we, the society, should not feel like we have to help that person out. That person should figure it out. And if they can't, well, then they can just seek out charity. And if they don't want to seek out, well, then that's their own problem. It's not our responsibility, because we're the strict father. It's not our responsibility to help them out, right? So their freedom, that person's freedom for conservatives, therefore lies in the fact that they don't get help. Opportunity, right? Prosperity. These are also words that conservatives take and they say, these are ours. So how do you make a country prosperous? Well, for more than 30 years now, conservatives have subscribed to the Laffer curve, to Reaganomics. Those are the ideas that for prosperity, what you do is you send all of the money to the very, very top, to only the super wealthy. And what the super wealthy will do to it is they will rain it down on us in jobs and all kinds of other things. Progressives believe, talking about freedom, opportunity, and prosperity here, freedom, a free man is not a necessitous man. Therefore, if you are hungry, you are not free. If you are homeless, you are not free. If you are sick and you cannot get health care, you are not free. Right? If you don't have a support system, you are not free. If you can't get a job because there are none, right, or you have to compete for jobs with very low wages, you are not free. That is also not opportunity, as far as progressives are concerned, and that is not prosperity. So the exact three words, freedom, opportunity, prosperity, right? If you look them up in the dictionary, progressives and conservatives will read the dictionary definition and we will all nod our heads and we will say, yes, that's what it is. But then if you ask a conservative what freedom, prosperity, and opportunity are, and then ask a progressive and a conservative, they'll both tell you completely different things. I want to give you a little bit more history about the conservative movement and the modern day progressive movement, and then I want to get more into the actual language that we need to start using for conservatives, for us to be able to communicate with conservatives. So, quoting here from the book, back in the 1950s, conservatives hated each other. The financial conservatives hated the social conservatives. The libertarians did not get along with the social conservatives or the religious conservatives. And many social conservatives were not religious. A group called conservative leaders, they got together around William F. Buckley Jr. You've probably heard of him. And others, and started asking what the different groups of conservatives had in common, whether they, you know, what they could all agree on in order to promote the general progressive, or excuse me, the general conservative cause. They started magazines, they started think tanks, and they invested billions of dollars in the conservative movement. And as a matter of fact, I was asking myself after the election, I said, my idea for religious conservatives, my idea of religion, my idea of what Jesus is, what Jesus did, what does, what he believes in, you know, what the gospel is, I said, it doesn't seem to comport with what Donald Trump was selling to his supporters. Yet, he got 83% of the fundamentalist Christians, right, of these diehards, these people that said that they follow Christ. why the hell was that? Well, there's an article by Molly Worthen, also in this month's Atlantic, called A Match Made in Heaven. And it talks about why so many people flocked to Donald Trump. So many of these religious, deeply religious people flocked to Donald Trump. And it's because of something called the prosperity gospel. Get that. The prosperity gospel. The prosperity gospel is based on the idea that the more you have, the more Jesus loves you. And because it is not believed that you are able to attain all of these things without the blessing of God. So it doesn't so much matter what you do. Of course, you got to do a little bit. They've got another belief. God helps those who help themselves. But the more that you get is proof that God loves you. That's the prosperity gospel. We used to refer to it as Calvinism back in the 1500s, for 1400s, 1500s. We called it Calvinism. This is John Calvin, the father of Calvinism. And he had the exact same belief. He goes, how do you know who God loves? It's pretty clear. When God loves you, he provides you with much. When he does not, then you are poor and you are hungry and you're homeless and all these other things. To take that and try to comport it with the idea that God loves us all has never made a lot of sense to me. But it doesn't matter. A lot of your modern day conservatives believe in the prosperity gospel. So the conservative groups got together, right? This is just before the Powell memo. And I'll talk to you about the Powell memo. And they said, you know, we're all conservative. You know, we're not going to get every single thing that we want. But we can get most of what we want. We can get almost all of what we want if we all come together. Then came the Powell memo. It's very infamous. 1970, Lewis Powell, quoting here, just 2 months before he became a Supreme Court justice appointed by Nixon. At the time, he was the chief counsel to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. He wrote a memo called the Powell Memo, and it was a fateful document. He said the conservatives had to keep the country's best and brightest young people from becoming what he referred to as anti-business. What we need to do, Powell said, is to set up institutes within the universities and outside the universities. We have to do research. We've got to write books. We have to endow professorships to teach these people the right way to think. After Powell went to the Supreme Court, these ideas were taken up by William Simon, the father of present William Simon. At the time, the elder Simon was Secretary of the Treasury under Nixon. He convinced some very wealthy people, Coors, Scaife, Olin, to set up the Heritage Foundation. The Olin professorships and the Olin Institute at Harvard and other institutions. These institutes have done their job really well. People associated with them have written books, more books than people on the left have, on all issues. The conservatives support their intellectuals. They create media opportunities. They have media studios down the hall and institutes so that getting on television is easy. 80% of the talking heads on television are from conservative think tanks. 80%. Progressives have set up no such thing. See, for conservatives, it is my belief, not for your average conservative voters, the people that support Donald Trump. My belief with respect to those folks is that they want the same thing. I'm talking about the voters here. They want the same thing that I want. They want a job with some security, access to health care, food, if quality time with their family. I think that these are not political things. I think that we all want those things. But how we get to those things, well, that's where it changes. And so we tend to follow, with respect to those in D.C., two different groups. So let's talk about the leaders now, or the people that represent the progressives and the conservatives. The conservatives, the Republicans in D.C. and in state houses and in the different congresses, they effing hate you. They hate you. They hate this country. They want to watch it burn to the ground, and they want to collect the insurance money. And for progressives, well, the old-time progressives, I'm not talking about the new third rail progressives, but the old progressives, say the progressives of the 70s and the 80s, you know, which is where they started to change, They simply wanted progress and acceptance and inclusiveness. And so the idea for the leaders of these two movements, the conservative and progressive movements, it's obviously a lot more a powerful emotion to get everything, right? To get all the money and all the power. That emotion is way more powerful than this idea that progressives had of an egalitarian society. And as such, the conservatives, the leaders of the conservative movement, they have hundreds of think tanks. They've got news sites which do not spread news, do not engage in journalism. They only spread horrible, horrible right-wing ideas. And then conservative voters, now we're talking about the average people, the working people, conservative voters then go to only those news sites, all right? And all the ideas come from only those think tanks. And then they become very wary of anybody that is not those think tanks or those news sites or those groups. And the progressives have set up nothing like that. And now we have all of this Orwellian language. Do you remember the Clear Skies Initiative, or the Clear Skies Act, which did what? It allowed people, it allowed polluters to dump more of their waste in the skies, right? And conservatives are very good at this, using Orwellian language to name bills. And let's talk about some conservative frames. So when we talk about taxes, conservatives will use a phrase, and this comes from their think tanks. They'll use a phrase like tax relief. Now, what does relief suggest? Relief suggests that somebody is being hurt, right? That somebody is being attacked, that somebody needs some sort of relief. Quoting here from the book, a conservative will go on TV and use two words like tax relief, and the progressive has to go into a paragraph-long discussion on his own view because he doesn't have this very narrow bumper sticker talking point. The conservative can appeal to an established frame that taxation is an affliction or a burden, which allows for the two-word phrase, tax relief. I used to belong to a punk rock group called Two-Word Culture, and that's where the idea came from. It was that whole bumper sticker mentality, but I digress. But there is no established frame for progressives. You can talk about it, but it takes some doing because there's not an established frame, no fixed idea out there. In cognitive science, there's a name for this phenomenon. It's called hypocognition. The lack of ideas you need, the lack of a relatively simple fixed frame that can be evoked by a word or two. Progressives are suffering from massive hypocognition. The conservatives used to suffer from it. When Goldwater lost in 64, they had very few of the concepts that they have today. In the intermediate 40 years, conservative think tanks, thinkers have filled their conceptual gaps, but our conceptual gaps as progressives is still there. So what might be a better way for progressives to, say, frame the taxation issue? We've only got an hour here. I'm not going to be able to get into certainly all of it, but I want to take this one in particular. Okay, quoting here, taxation is paying your dues, paying your membership fee in America. If you join a country club or community center, you pay fees. Why? You did not build the swimming pool, you have to maintain it. You did not build the basketball court, someone has to clean it. You may not use the squash court, but you still have to pay your dues. Otherwise, it won't be maintained and it will fall apart. People who avoid taxes, like corporations that move to Bermuda, are not paying their dues to the country. It's patriotic to be a taxpayer. It is traitorous to desert our country and not pay your dues. Perhaps Bill Gates Sr. said it best in arguing to keep the inheritance tax, what the conservatives like to call the death tax. He pointed out that he and Bill Jr. did not invent the internet. They just used it to make billions. There's no such thing as a self-made man. I remember President Obama just got excoriated when he pointed that out. Every businessman has used the vast American infrastructure, which the taxpayers paid for, to make his money. He did not make his money alone. He used taxpayer infrastructure. He got rich on what other taxpayers had paid for. The banking system, the Federal Reserve, the Treasury, the Commerce Departments, and the judicial system, where 9/10 of cases involve corporate law. These taxpayer investments support companies and wealthy investors. There are no self-made men. The wealthy have gotten rich using what previous taxpayers have paid for. They owe the taxpayer of this country a great deal and should be paying it back. So there's a lot of talk about repatriation right now. Corporations are saying, we'll bring our tax dollars back to America if you lower the tax rate and you let us bring it back. But we've done repatriation before. And what they do instead, and by the way, say someone like Apple sitting on like $100 billion, right? What happens is we lower the tax rate, they bring it back, but then they just give more money to their senior executives so that the people that already have way too damn much, they're going to get even more. The idea that God loves you is the more that you have. And so if you're a conservative, you believe that rich people don't have enough and poor people have too much. That's if you're a conservative leader. And if you're, say, one of the rubes that just follows along, and I'm sorry to use that kind of language, but if you follow the line of thinking that's put out by these conservative think tanks, it makes you, the working person, even poorer. When you argue for something like taking away welfare or taking away housing assistance, right? But giving tax breaks to billionaires, people who already have money, giving them more money, and then the people that don't have any money, telling them to go to hell, you're making a case against yourself too. Taxes are not an affliction. They're the dues that we pay for being a part of a civilized society. And there's a lot of conservatives right now on the internet. Breitbart for one, Drudge for another, right? And these guys make gutloads of money using the internet created by the federal government, but they don't think that they have a responsibility to pay for it. My dad blew my mind one time when he said, hey, why should I have to pay for kids to be educated, talking about how his property taxes go to the schools. I don't particularly care for property taxes, but we'll get into that another time. But I think there's other ways to pay for school. But I said, hey, we pay taxes to pay for schools because we don't want dumb kids. And we also don't want kids that don't have the means in order to take care of themselves. You know, they need to learn how to communicate. They need to know how to do math and all these other things. And you don't realize it, but you benefit when that kid doesn't break into your car and steal your stereo because he has other ways to. And of course, this guy, whoop, right over. I think just goes right over.
But why do I have to pay for it?
Okay, because we are a society. When talking about marriage, conservatives use two words. Definition, as in definition of marriage, and sanctity, the sanctity of marriage. Quoting here, anthropological studies of American marriages have shown that they got the definition wrong. Marriage is an ideal and is defined as the realization of love through lifelong public commitment. Love is sacred in America, so is commitment. There is sanctity in marriage, and it is the sanctity of love and commitment. But back in 2004, the presidential candidates, the nominees, tried to sidestep the issue because they didn't know how to talk about it. John Kerry and Howard Dean claimed their marriage is a matter for the church, while the proper role for the civil for the state is civil unions and a guarantee of material benefits. This argument makes little sense. The ability of ministers and priests and rabbis to perform marriage ceremonies is granted by governments, not religions. And when Obama ran for president in 2008, he did this same thing. He goes, hey, marriage is for the church and civil unions, civil commitments are for, for government. But they can't be marriage because that's religion only. And then he came out in 2012 and he goes, yeah, marriage. Boom. Full marriage. And I hear the argument all the time that the government needs to get out of the marriage game. They're not in the marriage game. But the churches get their power and their right to operate from the government because we have decided that churches are a good and that we should have them in society for the positive things they do. Getting people to back Trump, not one of those things. So when trying to communicate with a conservative, and you're a progressive, right? If you're a conservative, you don't need this. But if you're a progressive and you want to communicate with a conservative, you need to first understand their worldview In general, conservatives believe that that people are born evil and that they need to be made better through a strict parent model. And progressives believe that people are born good and simply need to be nurtured and helped along. And this also is borne out in the way we as parents raise our kids. I was raised in a conservative household. Single mother, but a conservative household. And I got my ass whooped on damn near a daily basis. And when my mom was too tired to do it, she got one of her boyfriends to do it. I know it's a sad story. And then when I talk with other conservative parents, I said, you gotta whoop it, right? My mom used to say, don't spare the rod, you know? Beat the piss out of that kid. Because when they grow up, they're gonna be good and they're gonna be strong. I've heard folks say before, conservative folks, the reason I'm not in jail is because my mama whooped my ass. No, no, no. No, no, no. That is not why you're not in jail. Not in jail because you don't want to be in jail. Because what it takes to get to jail, you decided not to do. In my house, and we're progressives, we're raising our kids without hitting them. We don't hit them. We've never hit them. Not belts, not tree switches, not fists. We don't hit our kids. I believe they were born good, and I'm simply trying to nurture them. Now, this doesn't mean that they don't get out of hand. It doesn't mean that they don't anger me, because they do. They are kids, and one of them is becoming a teenager right now, and I got another teenager right behind her. And I know they're going to piss me off because, you know, they're boys and all kinds. I don't want to get into it. But I didn't hit because I didn't think that that's the way you make your child good. And once they're out of the house, I'm going to let them be on their own, but it's not going to be completely hands-off. And when they come to me, I'm going to hear them, and I'm going to try to help them any way I can, whenever I can. So just understand that when you're talking to conservatives, you're talking with somebody who generally is going to fall under the strict parent model. That's their politics. And for progressives, it's the nurturant parent. So here are some better ways to talk about to talk with conservatives about particular issues. And remember, don't use their frames. When they say we need tax relief, point out that taxes aren't an affliction. They're the cost of living in a civilized society. Don't call it when they use the war on terror. You can't have a war on a tactic. But what you should say is if people are carrying out these heinous acts, we should find out who they are like we did after the original bombing of the World Trade Center, lock those people up, treat them like criminals, and put them in prison for life, rather than going to war with an entire region. When talking about the environment, point out that we shouldn't be trashing the environment because, as the Pope points out, we need to be good stewards of God's creation. And that, remember, if we destroy the environment, there's not going to be a place for your precious corporations or for you to exist for that matter. You know, don't use their frames. With the Iraq war, I was probably one of the strongest people against it because I'm just very much against the idea of going into someone's country and removing their leaders and killing and da da da. It's just not. But George Bush came out and he stood on that smoldering rubble on 9/11 and he said, evil men did this and they're going to hear from you. And the natural inclination for most people is going to be vengeance. We were all upset. And progressives weren't particularly great by that time. But conservatives very much got up and they said, evil men did this and those evil men will be answered. And how in the hell do you argue with that? And now we have been in Iraq for 14, 15 years, something of that nature, 15, 16, something like that. I think we've been in Afghanistan even longer. And the fact that we're spending trillions, not billions, trillions, a number I promise you that you cannot even wrap your head around. We're spending trillions, right? Not to mention all the people that have died, both that live in Iraq and Afghanistan, as well as our own soldiers, all the people that have been maimed in the hundreds of thousands, if not millions, killed and maimed. And we all really easily got walked into that. What we should have done as progressives was stood up and said, we need, and you so use some of their language, but not necessarily, it's because we believe in the same thing. Use some of the language, but not their frames. All right, these men are evil. The men that made, that did it, you know, carried out 9/11, were criminal. And we, as progressives, we want to protect the nation just as much as anybody else does. But we don't want to get into a long, drawn-out, expensive war with both a high treasury cost and a high human cost. So what we would like is an honest-to-goodness investigation, which was really hard to get because George W. Bush and Dick Cheney wouldn't even go under oath when it came to talking about it. Because when it comes to the leaders of that party, of the Republican Party, they're not interested in the good, and they're not interested in workers, and they're not interested in peace, and they're not really interested in prosperity or any of that stuff. That's only the voters. That's only the average working people like you and I. Those are the things that we want. So therefore, they mean absolutely nothing to the leaders of the Republican Party. So here we are, nearing the 100-day mark. There's an article by Lawrence Douglas over at The Guardian, and it's titled, Trump's First 100 Days Were a Stress Test for Democracy. We have learned one crucial lesson since January 20th. We are not Germany 1933. I shared the fear that Trump represented an existential threat to American democracy. I'm not convinced those fears have been entirely allayed. But the first 100 days of the Trump presidency have demonstrated that American institutions and traditions of democratic constitutionalism are not as easily deconstructed as Steve Bannon might have hoped. We should be proud of the resistance shown by our civil society. Ordinary citizens have taken to the streets in record numbers. We've confronted our representatives in town hall meetings. We have flooded members of Congress with letters and emails and appearances. We've organized ourselves into groups such as Daily Action, mobilizing the energies of millions unwilling to quietly acquiesce in the destruction of American democracy. In 1 week, the ACLU received more online contributions than it typically receives in 6 years. Art supply stores are enjoying gravy days as Americans rush to purchase poster boards and magic markers, the low-tech tools of a peaceful protest. We should be proud of our so-called, as Trump referred to them to, federal judges, who in jurisdictions from Massachusetts to an island in the Pacific have put a stop to Trump's travel bans that have now barred the administration from penalizing sanctuary cities by withholding federal funds. These judges appointed by Democratic and Republican presidents have demonstrated the indispensability of judicial independence to the maintenance and preservation of our constitutional values. So that's a shout out to us. You know, we as indivisible, you know, we that are taken to the streets and marching peacefully, you know, we that are peacefully calling up our representatives. By the way, if you're shouting at them at town halls, you're not doing any good. So that's the good news. Where is the bad news? Okay, here it comes. By Cornell West, the Democrats have delivered one thing in the past 100 days, disappointment. That's right. They have delivered disappointment. So here's what we have right now. The modern day Republican Party, I'm talking about the leaders here, what the people want. I believe we as Democrats and Republicans, we all want the same thing. What we disagree on is the means to get it. So for the Republican Party, they say that they have all the answers for this, that, and the other. They've come up with an answer for everything because they've got the media, they've got the think tanks, they've got the right? And for progressives, they've said, well, at least we're not the Republicans. And they say, look, if you don't like the Republican ideas, well, then you only have one other choice, the Democrats. And that's not a real good way to make your case. The Republicans, for whatever fallacies lie within their arguments, they're making a case. It's not a good case. It's not a case that I agree with, but they're out there making a case. And for Democrats, they're simply going, at least we're not them. That's not a good case. And you see the people in the streets making the case for what they want. Access to education, access to healthcare, access to clean water, access to food, right? Good jobs so that they can take care of their families. That's what every single working person wants. But from the parties, well, from the Republicans, we're getting, well, we only want to help out rich people. And from the Democrats, we're getting, hey, we're not the Republicans. that's not a good choice. If the Democrats don't want to lose again in 2018 and 2020, and they very well could, what they need to do is they need to make the case for single payer. They need to make the case for $15 an hour. They need to make the case for us not spending tons and tons of money on war. They need to make the case for a value-added tax, which is in effect a tariff. And they need to point out why all of us can get under that umbrella. And Democrats can run on this progressive thing that Bernie Sanders ran on, right? And it can't be Bernie again. He's up there in years. He's going to be damn near 80 by the time 2020 comes around. But in 2018, we can make a strong progressive case, and we can say, here's what our ideas are. Here's what we can do, and appeal to those things that Democrats and Republicans all agree on. Fair wages, the things that poll really well. Democrats could make those cases because, see, Republicans are making those cases, but then they're not delivering on those. For all of the talk that the Republicans and for Donald Trump, all they made, you know, during the 2016 election, we want to help you out, want to help your families out, want to get the jobs and all this other stuff. He's done the exact opposite of every single thing that he said. So you go, aha, then he's definitely going to lose in 2018, and he's definitely going to lose in 2020. Not necessarily. No, he could if the Democrats make a strong case, but he won't if the only thing the Democrats have to run on is we're not them. And who else are you going to pick? Huh? There are no viable third parties in America. So, in conclusion, there's no reason why we as Democrats and Republicans cannot talk to each other. Whether you realize it or not, we really do want all of the same things. Our leaders are not listening to us. Democratic leaders aren't listening to me. Republican leaders, to my conservative friends, they're not listening to you. They, by and large, do not care what we want. And why should they do anything any differently? We continue to send them to Congress even though they are not listening to us, and they've shown that they don't care. So what we need to do is we need to band together. For conservatives, you need to start talking to progressives, and you need to not subscribe to the cartoonish idea that's been sold to you by conservative outlets of what a liberal is. And liberals, the same for you. You can't have those same kind of ideas about conservatives. Yeah, I've lashed them on this microphone, called them dummies and all kinds of that's not nice. That's not diplomatic. I shouldn't be doing that. I honestly believe that we really do want the same thing. But our leaders, they're not just not listening to me. They're not listening to you either. And we can get the same thing, right? And it doesn't have to necessarily fall under one of these two banners, a Democratic or Republican. It could simply be human. And conservatives, when you're talking to your progressive friends, remember the frames that they believe in. The nurturant parent. Not pansies or pussies or any of this. The nurturant parent. And remember that when you're talking to conservatives, it's really more the strict father model. But even though we're different and we think differently, we really do want the same things. So we can get together and we can talk. We can say what we want, and then how we're going to get there, we can compromise a little. Not everyone's going to get what they want, but everybody might get a little bit. And we can have that power in our own hands. I don't know why we've chosen to do it this way, to just scream at each other or scream past each other. It isn't doing any good, and nobody's getting anywhere. Republicans celebrated the night that Donald Trump shocked the world and he won, because they thought that when Donald Trump won, they, the Republicans, they, the conservatives, they, the religious, they thought that they won too. They didn't realize that night that when progressives lost, they lost as well. They're learning now. They're trying to ignore it. But every day is like a year right now. It seems like it takes forever. And there's all these constant news alerts. We can only take that for so long. Progressives, eventually, they're going to be there with us as well. And when they're there, you got to be ready for them. You got to be ready to talk with them. And more important than that, you've got to be willing to talk with them. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for being here on The Fire You Can't Put Out. Our official home is TFY. CPO.podbean.com. Like us on Facebook at facebook.com/TFYCPO. You can listen on the go. Just download the Podbean app at the iTunes Store or at the Google Play Store for Android users. Individual episodes are available for download at the iTunes Store. Just search for The Fire You Can't Put Out. You know I don't record this part, right? I say this fresh every time. You can also subscribe so that you never miss an episode. Questions, comments, or hate mail, just a general statement or inquiry, you can email us at TFYCPO@gmail.com. We work hard to not only inform and entertain, but also to keep an open dialogue with our growing listener base. So for free to reach out to us, and as always, thank you for listening. We're the fire you can't put out, and we will prevail, rejecting austerity in favor of prosperity for everybody, everyone. Special thanks to Kipper for producing, and a special thanks to you for listening. This is Melvin signing off. Now that I've woken you up, good morning.